We'll just
wait, we'll just hold.
And that has to go to the, through the council process.
How many do we need for a quorum?
That's right.
I can't remember what the bylaws say.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, too.
I never thought that would happen.
But then you're on the,
It's 11, 11 or 12, isn't it?
I refer to.
We don't have a quorum.
11.
11.
Well, if I take my glasses off, I'll see double.
Well, there you go.
We'll just stay that until next meeting.
A quorum consists of a majority of the membership.
Doesn't that be six?
So you can't transact the business of the commission.
We count.
You can still meet, however, no action can be official.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay. So, are you guys, are Dennis and Sean included in the 11?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, so we'll just wait till next meeting to approve those then, and we don't have anybody from.
So we need one more person to arrive? Is that right?
We need six.
Right, so maybe we can.
Maybe a little bit.
We'll see, we'll see. But nobody is here from the public for comments, so Captain Anderson, that brings us to you. So I'm sure Dennis kind of told you about what we wanted to talk to you about tonight. But we wanted you to come just to let us know of issues that you see regarding human rights. So I don't know if you want to just kind of take it away, or.
Sure, you know, I'll probably do better fielding questions. I'm not sure exactly what you folks want to know from the police department, but, you know, I was talking with Sean earlier, and we do get occasional calls with what people identify as hate crimes. They're not always identified as hate crimes through statute, but they'll call up, whether it's somebody, you know, driving downtown with a Confederate flag and loud pipes, trying to intimidate folks. We do get those occasional calls. You know, our focus, certainly in the past several years at the police department, has been with the Somali community. As everybody knows, we've had a big influx here, and I think that we've made some really good relationships with a number of people in the Somali community. You know, they stop up regularly, various people will, with problems they have, and stop in and talk, whether it's, a lot of times it has nothing to do with crimes that are occurring, but just problems within their community that they want help with. And if we can't help them, we'll direct them to other resources. So that's, and we're still actively working on that partnership, but it's been really good, I think, specifically in the past 2 years. We've made some pretty good relationships in the Somali community where, and we understand that many of them that we have here don't view law enforcement as folks here view law enforcement, you know. Mm-hmm. Law enforcement in Somalia, they'll extort people, they'll beat people, so the level of trust is not like it is for most people who grew up here and is used to law enforcement. So mm-hmm. that's been a big hurdle. But one thing that we do have to our advantage is there are, you know, we're getting to second and third generation folks who have lived here and have grown up here and know what it's like here. So we've reached out a lot to those people, and that's been beneficial to us. So
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what questions you might have about mm-hmm. what we do, or, you know, we don't get a lot of human rights violation complaints at the department.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would just kind of ask a question about mental health issues. I mean, you get lots of calls. I work in mental health. I'm at Woodland, so we've got the crisis unit, the detox unit. And it can be a little, I'm sure, frustrating for you. You pick somebody up, and they obviously need their mental health, and they don't meet the criteria for one place or another.
It's a huge problem right now. And law enforcement from around the state has talked to the Department of Human Services about this. You know, as soon as all the state hospitals closed down, it created a huge void in services for folks. And this happens almost on a daily, for sure, a weekly basis here in our community, where you have somebody who's committed a crime, sure, and sometimes it's at the treatment facility they're at, whether it's MHU or crisis. Jail is not the place for them. You know, they're not equipped for that. The judges don't want to see them. The prosecutors don't want to see them. That's not the place for them, is the criminal justice system. But these places aren't equipped to deal with them either. You know, like MHU, they don't have the facilities to deal with them. They don't feel safe. They have workers up there who are not trained to deal with these people. And it's a gigantic problem right now throughout the state. It's a huge problem. And it's just not getting addressed. You know, we can get training and how to deal with folks with mental illnesses, but it still doesn't solve the problem of where to put them. There just are not beds in the state for them. It's a huge problem, and it is frustrating.
If you were to have an idea for our own community, where to start, what could we do? I mean, I know it's statewide, and I know there's not, but as far as the kind of relationships between law enforcement and crisis law enforcement and RICE, the emergency room staff, where can we as the providers do something? What do you see? I mean, limited funds and no place to go, but...
Yeah, you know, that's the roadblock that we have run into, is what do you do? You know, it's 2:00 in the morning, and we have a guy who is breaking out windows somewhere, and he doesn't have any clothes on. You know, clearly there's mental health issues. There's probably possibly some drug abuse issues. So our fallback is, you know, we're not equipped to deal with him. He's not going to jail in that condition. We take him to RICE. And we have regular meetings with RICE and with crisis on this exact topic. Mm-hmm. So nobody's getting left in the dark. Everybody kind of understands the problems everybody's facing. But yeah, what do you do with them? So we bring them to RICE. RICE has to put them through their ER before they're accepted into the MHU unit. So they'll evaluate them there at ER. Maybe they'll take them at the MHU unit if they have a bed. The MHU unit here was originally designed to be an acute treatment unit. It is not that anymore. They have people who are staying there 65, 75 days, and that's not what it's made for. And just by the lack of other services, that's what they're forced into doing. And you can't find beds in the state. And I know they struggle with it. I know they do, and I feel bad for their position too. And I do not have any good solutions for it. You know, the last meeting we had, we talked about you know, the state hospital here, when they had people that were out of control, they could put them in a room where they couldn't hurt themselves, where it was basically them in a cot, but not a jail. You know, they talked about that, and I don't know if that's realistic for them to be able to fund or manage or have personnel there, but that is the quandary that everybody in the state is in right now.
Barbara, were you in Minnesota when the state, when DHS dismantled the treatment centers? Were you here yet or not?
No.
Because
but it was pretty similar
them,
everywhere.
Yeah, with absolutely no backup plan.
Yeah.
It's like we're closing them down and there was nothing that followed it. Nothing. And there's things in the works. Well, that's been for 20 years now, but there is nothing.
Well, you know,
it's backup.
I was in Florida at the time, and one of the things they did was a couple of the county hospitals. Of course, this was Miami-Dade and Fort Lauderdale, Broward County, and they're pretty big communities. And the county hospitals built psychiatric emergency rooms. Mm-hmm. And one of them was in Hollywood, Florida. There was like you can drive in with the ambulance over here. It went right into the psych department and right to the psychiatric emergency room where they could be assessed and taken into a quiet room, maybe medicated, and then they had a floor for admitting, and so did Broward General. I'm not sure how that it was just getting going when I was kind of in that, you know, leaving there, I guess, but yeah, that was, then the problem was some controversy between the medical staff and the psych staff and the medical doctors that didn't want to do the they didn't want to walk from their department to that department to do the physical exam, so they were working it out, but.
Yeah, and you know, here.
That would be ideal, but.
Yeah, and I think it's just a personnel issue here, you know. The ER is busy, and then you flop a couple more people in there on top of medical emergencies, you know, people who have to be screened for mental health, and they're just, it's a staffing issue for them.
All it takes is one rowdy.
Yeah.
The facility that was built down by the county and the state to the southeast there, that was intended for this purpose, was it not?
Originally, it was. It is no longer a locked unit. It's a voluntary unit.
But why, apparently, it wasn't being used. What is that? What I've heard, it wasn't being used. Why would that be?
I don't know that it wasn't being used. We were down there a fair amount when it was still a locked unit.
Yeah.
I guess I hadn't heard that it wasn't being used. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm on the advisory for that. It just, the state just kept changing everything. And so now, yeah, it's up to 90 days now. But even with, you know, people coming out of Rice who need a longer term stay, it's still, they're not at all being used as they were initially intended. And it now it's different than what it started out as. But none of them, those facilities around the state, are being used as what DHS said they were going to when they closed down the treatment centers.
Why is that, anyways? Because I've been curious.
I've got an idea. I think conversations take place with the Commissioner of Human Services, and then they get a new commissioner, and you start over from ground zero again with the same talks that you had maybe for the previous 3 years. I know that's happened with the law enforcement community for a number of years, where you get to where you're thinking you're making headway, the commissioner changes, and then you're back to where you started from. That's been one of our frustrations anyway.
If I understand right, some of those facilities have closed in the state.
Yeah, some of them have completely closed.
And if there's a shortage of beds, I don't understand why, because you had beds set aside, even if it's long-term, not short-term, the long-term would help the problem at Rice that you're talking about.
Right, and it is, it's a funding issue, it is a change in administration issue. The only treatment center that is like what we used to have is Anoka Ramsey now, and there are very few beds there. I mean, our youth are going to Fargo or Sioux Falls. I mean,
because they closed the one out here.
Yeah, when they come into Rice, if they have to take them somewhere, they're taking them to Prairie St. John's, or if there's no beds there, they're taking them to Sioux Falls. I mean, it's
and especially for if they're under 18.
Yeah, that's what I mean with the youth. Yeah, it's and.
But if I understood right, at the one out here, the census was shrinking also. It wasn't being used to the same extent as it was a decade.
Oh, it's full.
It was always full?
And there are 16 beds there, I think, and it's, they're always pretty much at capacity.
Over there, the one by the Y?
Well, I was thinking for a while. The adolescent treatment unit out here.
That was PLYP?
That was closed.
No, not Prairie Lakes, but the.
No, not Prairie
Lakes. The one on campus.
Yeah. When it was the campus, it was adolescent treatment unit.
Because that was an adolescent.
Yes.
Mental unit.
Yeah.
And that wasn't used as much.
Right.
The census was shrinking. But there, that's a youth program. And why was it? Why was the census shrinking if there's no other facilities in the state?
It really wasn't shrinking. It was, again, a DHS thing as they were downsizing it. And then they had the small behavioral unit for youth out there. It's... Every change in administration, just like the governor, just like, you know, every time it changes, DHS, you know, flips over too. So.
The one thing that was in place when I first came here, I came in 2013, and they had the ERTS, the intensive residential treatment programs, and we had one, and there was one over near the city somewhere, and those were the last two, and we had to close ours because we couldn't, it was a personnel problem. They couldn't really keep it staffed properly, and then the facility itself needed so much improving as far as to keep it up to code, it was, they couldn't afford it, so it just closed. That was, what, 2 years ago?
And the percentage.
And where was that one located?
Atwater. But it was with, it was a Woodlands program.
Was that the Francis House?
Was that, yeah.
Oh, St. Francis House.
St. Francis was a lot, was, that was way, way back, yeah.
But it's that facility, was that building facility?
Yeah, it was an old house and they fixed it up and then they bought another house next to it to, and it just wasn't really, they, you know, it had construction issues that weren't getting to code and then they couldn't staff it. They couldn't find the staff to really do it and the money would, and they had to close it. The money wasn't coming in to help either.
Yeah, the folks that we have problems with are a very small percentage of the folks with mental health problems. You know, it's probably a 2% of the population, but those 2% are getting juggled around the places they shouldn't be and not getting the care they need.
You know, I'm surprised and I'm pleased to hear that you don't encounter many situations of discrimination or racial problems at all. I that just really surprises me. I thought you would get calls and somebody would say, well, you know, this person is picking on me because I'm whatever.
There are certainly times and calls when, you know, people maybe feel like a crime is racially motivated, but what can be charged out and what somebody feels is racially motivated are oftentimes two different things. You know, to prove a hate crime, there's a list of things that's fairly extensive. But, you know, for as diverse as a population that we have, you know, we don't get the amount of calls that one would think for the hate type crimes.
And that's excellent. I mean, that's good news for this committee to hear, because it's not what I really expected to hear from you.
Sure.
But it's good news.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about homelessness? How much does the...
You know, there's obviously an uptick in the summer months. We had two regular homeless people that were here on a regular basis. One of them chose to be here year-round. And there's not, you know, there's no churches that will take homeless people. The Salvation Army is, they do what they can, but their funding is limited too. They have a program where they will allow, if there's somebody, and it's not for people who are homeless per se, it's for people who are maybe getting a fight with a spouse and have nowhere to stay for the night, where we can put them up in a hotel for a night, and the Salvation Army picks up the bill. But that's very, very short term.
Haven't the churches gone together?
Family Promise.
I think Lutheran Brotherhood too has.
If you have any contact with Family Promise, I'm on the board for the Family Promise. It's a faith-based program, and it's a little difficult right now because it's a program that the referral sources come from Heartland, or sometimes they find a brochure they call, and you know, Heartland or Salvation Army. But right now we don't have anybody in it, and it gets a little complicated. Because the way Family Promise is set up, there's no real policies because it's not government regulated. It's we get the referrals and then they have to go through a screening process. But ideally what it's set up to do is like somebody who comes and it's a mom and four kids and they don't have a place to live and they need some help, they're taken in. But the understanding is we're gonna get you to a job, we're going to get you on services, and we're going to get you housing, and it takes a period of time. And that's a 90-day kind of program. It takes a fair amount of work. And so we've had some people come in and do very well. We've had some people come in and say, oh, this is too much work, and they take off. But they stay in a church for a week, and then after that week is done, they move to another church. And my church, the First Presbyterian Church, is the day center. So they go there during the day and they're on the computers, hopefully, and lining up childcare and jobs, and so right now we don't have anybody in the program.
Yeah, if there are resources here that somebody knows of, I would be open to taking any resources you have, you know, because during the daytime, you know, we can scramble and make phone calls, and the Salvation Army is open, and, you know, we can refer them to local churches. But at 1 o'clock in the morning, when somebody walks in, you know, short of sleeping on the floor in the law enforcement center, there's not a lot of places. You know, we bought them bus tickets in the past. We've had officers go out and buy them meals out of their own pocket. But short of that, there's not any outlets for us. There's no long-term shelters.
Yeah, and the thing about the Family Promise Program is that there was that screening process. So it's not like, oh, you found a family sitting by the side of the road. They might do better to get a room from Salvation Army for a night or two, and then they'll make the connection to Family Promise, and then they get set up. And, you know, there's, it's a, you know, they do a lot of work to get them homes and jobs and get established, not just a stopgap measure. Of course, we do have a few walk-ins from time to time, but anyways.
So where is that?
That's the director of Family Promise.
Do you have an office, or you run out of Heartland?
The day center is actually at the First Presbyterian Church, and the entrance is on the 7th Street side, and there's a buzzer, but there's the card. That's Chris is the director. So if you have any questions or you want to, that might be a good referral.
Family Promise is limited to families, or typically it's a parent and some children.
We've had a parent, a grandparent with kids. We did have a couple that didn't have kids, but that one who had a disability and was trying to get their disability going, and so they didn't have kids, but they were in the program for a period of time and got them sorted out too. That's the whole thing right now. There is some, you know, debate. You know, people want to have certain kinds of people there or not. I don't know. I mean, it's. I'm glad I'm on the board. Let me just put it that way.
Sure.
But it's. It's growing. I mean, it's been in open for a year, so keeping it with people in it has been a bit of a challenge, but they're working on it.
So what do you do with the family that you're backgrounding but has nowhere right now?
Well, they've put them up in a hotel for a few days so they sort things out or get the background checks back. But if it's one family, sometimes it's not, I don't think it's such a big deal, but when there's a background check that needs to go through and there's other families that are already there, there's room for 14 people. That's okay. About the cap, 14 to 15 people. And however that is configured among families, it could be more than two families or three even. So it's just that the housing is in the churches for a week at a time. 12 different churches, 11 different churches, I think, at this point. And they're fed there, and they sleep there, and then they get up in the morning and they go to the day center.
So are they supervised there at night, or is there nobody there besides
them? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Stay overnight.
The churches have people that stay with them and feed them and then get them to places they need to be, doctor's appointments and stuff during the day with the van. Basically, they're taught the public transportation system.
Okay.
So, but
no, that's great. Yeah, if that's a resource that
talk to
you can use,
give him a call. Mm-hmm. And you know, there we're working on some other kinds of things. You know, scenarios of, you know, what if it's a same-sex couple that comes in, or a gay parent and their kids. You know, churches sometimes aren't too fond of that, but. I speak up, and right now, I don't know, it hasn't really happened, but the scenarios have been presented.
Sure.
So.
And kind of on the same lines as homelessness, what about kids that run away from home So they're kind of temporarily homeless.
Sure.
How often do you deal with that?
Sure, quite a bit. And oftentimes, so when we come across that situation, we have two options that we have. We can issue an attempt to locate, which is kind of like just the local, the city police get it, the county police, or the county sheriff's department gets it, and the area state patrol will get it for an attempt to locate. Parents oftentimes use that when the kid has just run away and they know that they're probably at their friend's place and they're just not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
What that does is they're not entered into the state system as a missing. It's just locally we're looking for them. Mm-hmm. The second option is to report them missing through the state system. And what that does is we get all their information, clothing description, physical description, gets entered into state NCIC, and then it's broadcast to the entire nation. So if anybody comes in contact with them, any police officer, and runs their name, they'll come back as a missing person.
Mm-hmm.
So generally how it works is the county that reports them missing. So if we report somebody missing here and they turn up in Wisconsin, if there's not a court hold or court order in place, the parent is responsible to go pick them up. If there's a court order in place, then the county that originated the court order would be responsible for traveling out there to pick them up. And it does turn into babysitting sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we have somebody who has run away from Mille Lacs County and we have to wait for a parent to pick them up,
mm-hmm.
You know, oftentimes we'll opt not to take them to the crisis unit because by the time we get them signed in on a hold and the time their parent gets here, it's almost a wash.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's going to be more than a day, we'll sign them in to crisis on a police officer's hold. We try to find family, obviously, of course, or an adult friend, maybe a parents of a friend or somebody to take them until parents can get there. But usually we can deal with juveniles without it. It's just a time issue for the most part.
How often do you see runaway children? I mean, how often do you encounter that?
Finding them or reporting them missing?
Well, more so finding them, I guess, is a concern.
I think we have a pretty good clearance rate on the folks that are missing here.
I mean, just kids that are maybe running on the street and you find them and they've run away from home.
Oh, that's a pretty common occurrence.
Is that?
Yeah, okay. And I'll tell you, it's hard to find a 14-year-old kid who doesn't want to be found.
Right, right.
You know, that's difficult.
Yeah.
You end up kind of in a lot of wild goose chases, knocking on a lot of doors. But in a lot of cases, you know, after they've worn out their welcome with, you know, three or four friends, they show up back at home, and then we'll take them out of state system, but that's a pretty common occurrence, almost daily, where we're getting reports from kids not returning home after school. You know, they thought they were at a friend's place. We go to the friend's place, they're not there, parents get worried. But it's a lot of repeat offenders. You see a lot of the same kids where when we look up their history, you'll see, you know, you've had 12, 15 calls for the same thing where they just decide they don't want to come home.
Mm-hmm.
Those kids are hard to find. They know how to avoid detection.
Sure. I guess why I bring up these questions is I'm on the Willmar Area Women's Fund, and we have, you know, our main focus area right now is women and girls who are homeless and are subject to human trafficking.
Yep.
And so, you know, I just wondered how often you encounter that, because these girls that run away from home are very susceptible to be picked up by the wrong people.
We have one now that I just posted on our Facebook page today, actually, that that's always, of course, in the back of your mind, but some a little more than others. And this one, the human trafficking thing concerns me. And I think it happens more, certainly, than the general public realizes, and probably more than law enforcement realizes, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a topic that's gained a lot of speed and recognition lately, and I think probably went unnoticed for a lot of years.
Right.
So there's a lot of good training going on right now, though, with hotels and investigators. We're going to be doing some training with some local area hotels coming up here next month, I think, on signs to look for and, you know, what we as law enforcement expect from hotels and motels when we show up there, you know, what they'll experience, what questions they need to answer, and so some good awareness stuff going on.
Good.
Well, kind of along the same lines, but the mental health thing again, with mobile crisis, you're familiar with the new mobile crisis
yep.
unit, I hope. Yeah, and how do you see that working, or how do you see a coordinated effort when you get a call? And do you have people, I know I've seen it in other communities where they do a ride-along mental health with a in a cop car running around and looking, you know, when you get a call for a mental health issue. Have you done that? Have we done that here in Wilmer?
Have mental health professionals ridden with
yeah.
law enforcement officers?
A ride-along.
I'm not sure. It's open to anybody, though. Yeah. I don't know that the mental
health I think that would be a great idea. I mean, for both you and the mental health.
Yeah, that would be good. And
to deal with.
Yeah, and is everybody familiar with what the mobile crisis unit is here?
No.
So the mobile crisis unit is a unit that Woodland Centers, they started actually many years ago, but it was sparsely manned. You know, it was like from 8 o'clock in the morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon or something, where if you came into contact with somebody who maybe didn't fall into the category of needing to sign in to a police officer's hold, but were having maybe some depression issues or issues that were beyond the scope of law enforcement to deal with, we could call the mobile crisis unit. They would come out. They had mental health professionals that would talk to this person and have some other resources available to them. In this last year, there was a big grant and some extra funding where now the mobile crisis unit covers, I think, 3 counties or 4 counties, and they're manned 24/7. Mm-hmm. That was always the big problem that law enforcement had is, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night, and we need somebody here, and, you know, they weren't available, so we'd have to find other routes. Now they're available, so we've got a pretty good partnership where they'll come out, and their goal is to be there within 40 minutes from anywhere, because they've got mental health professionals all over this 3-4 county area. They just have to get it cleared through their home office, and then they'll arrive out on scene and try to help facilitate whatever needs to be done, whether it's just maybe some counseling or housing options or whatever. And if sometimes they're still going to need to be signed in and taken to a facility, and we, of course, then would do that. But, yeah, that's, I am so happy. I liked the program when they started it, but it was just not user-friendly
sure.
for us because, you know, and the cops are getting frustrated because they have this program and, okay, it's 4:30, now what? You know, well, we'll haul them in, and you know that's not what you like to do either, is haul them in to sign them in on a hold or whatever. So opening their hours up has been great, and we're using them a lot out at the jail actually. When we get, a lot of times folks will get arrested with mental health issues and they'll get RPR'd, released by a judge the next day, as they should, but there's nowhere for them to go, and they may still be having some depression issues or suicidal issues. When those instances happen, we get a hold of the mobile crisis. They come out, have a counseling session with them right at the jail, and if they think they need to be signed in, then they'll call law enforcement. We'll evaluate them and sign them in if need be, but oftentimes they're able to mediate things and get them stable enough where they can function for a time. So
they're a very avid team. They're all excited about doing
yeah.
it, you know?
Yep.
It's good. Hopefully they'll do some good.
Yeah, oh, yeah, we've used them a lot already, so.
Good.
I'm going to go in a different, terrible direction, but I'm going to throw a fastball here.
Sure.
I would concur, it's great that we don't have a lot of calls that you would deem as HR violation type things. Go on the other way. Police force, often tagged as perhaps being a violator of HR issues. In Wilmer, how have we dealt with that? What kind of trainings do we have to make sure we're not doing profiling and some of those other things that catch a lot of attention?
Sure. Yeah, and we still keep tabs on traffic stops and who we're stopping and who we're not, the race, gender, all that stuff. And we get, you know, we haven't had any complaints of profiling from the public. You know, the kind of complaints, I guess, that we get in regards to human rights is somebody feels there's been excessive use of force. When those happen, we have a system in place for investigating those kind of complaints. And those are few and far between. I don't think the city is, I can't think of any that the city has lost on since I've been here. There very well could have been, and I wouldn't have been privy to it before my current position. But and we're always looking for training. You know, we have use of force training that we do. The state requires 4 hours a year. We do 16. And we try to go above and beyond what the Minnesota Police Officers Board requires for training. We always do. We exceed it by many, many hours every year. But we're always looking for training on diversity and, you know, it doesn't seem like a lot of that gets out here. You know, I can remember a number of years ago where they housed it citywide, and it was at the fire department. They had a speaker come in. And I would be really interested in something created from the Somali community here locally that they put together here on what things they see or what concerns they have with the general public or assimilation issues or law enforcement issues or communication issues. I mean, you know, when you think of somebody who doesn't speak the language, I mean, think if you're in an emergency and you got to pick up a phone and try to communicate with somebody on the other end of what's going on. I mean, it seems like a small problem, but that can be a huge problem if you're on the other end of the phone. So, yeah, I would welcome anything that would be offered here in the area as far as that's concerned. So if anybody hears of anything, please let me know. If you have any ideas for good speakers, that would be a welcome sight.
Yeah, we're sort of looking at, you know, what kind of direction we're going to take. A woman from the St. Cloud Human Rights Commission came, and their big problem was homelessness, right? And so they did all this work with it. But I think we're kind of still looking at what our focus might be.
You know, and we're getting a Karen population here, too.
Right.
And when we first got calls on them, we couldn't find an interpreter. You know, there's a dialect that you couldn't find an interpreter for. And we didn't know, we had no idea where to turn to. So there are some other areas, too. Like, I'll admit, I know very little about the Karen population. I don't know what their traditions are. I don't know. But I think we'll probably end up with a larger population.
They're moving here. I have a friend and a student who's Karen, and I've been to the Baptist church some and had Karen food. And she, her name is Cora Poor, she does quite a bit of interpreting now.
Locally?
Yep.
Oh, I would like to get her name, please.
It's Kor. It's K-O-R, K-O-R.
You don't know her number, do you?
I will.
Can I give you my email address?
Card? Why don't you give me your card?
Yeah,
and I'll,
that'd be great.
You, so she's been doing some interpreting for the schools over the summer.
That's her name, Burma.
And she's a grown, she's a grown-up now.
Sure.
And she's not my student anymore.
Yeah, we've got some really good Latin interpreters and really good Somali interpreters, but there's a population that's certainly getting missed. So,
yeah, she's a kind of a leader type, right? She really is a kind of not just a quiet retiring person. She is.
Do you know if she court certified?
I'm not sure.
Okay, because I'm sure they would be looking for that too.
Right.
The court system would.
I'll talk to her.
Yeah, please.
Yep. Well, we want to respect your time, Captain Anderson. We appreciate you coming, but
I am sorry for bailing.
No. We are grateful for you to come.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, maybe it's not the end of your day. Could be the beginning of your day.
Yeah, it's just starting. So, no, thank you, and sorry for bailing early.
Have fun at football practice.
Things to do. Thanks to you and to the whole police department.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes.
Yep. We should
thank
have
you.
See ya. Nice to meet everyone.
Okay. Take care.
All right. Well, before,
yes,
that's what I was going to say. Let's do take care of that business.
We could have kept him for hours.
We know. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
He has. He coaches a football team, and they're playing at 6 o'clock. So he thought he should get there and corral them.
Yeah. So, Sean, you've moved to approve the minutes, so do we have a second?
I'll second it.
Second, any discussion? All right. So, motion approved.
All those in favor?
All in favor, thanks. All right. So, any thoughts on what Captain Anderson talked about?
I really do. It is unfortunate that some of our other members are not here tonight, because I think it's starting to play out that I think perhaps some kind of outreach to some of our certain populations might be there. I don't know what it would look like, but an educational piece out there, I don't know. The cultural thing, I've seen that done so much, it just seems overdone, but maybe it needs to be done again. You know, where there's cultural differences to explain those, and maybe it's just because I've been immersed in it too much, but that may need to come back. And I think if you were to approach the communities, Corin community, Somali community, they would probably put a group together that would be willing to work with the police department. I mean, and we could serve as a liaison between them. I think that's a really cool idea.
They did that somewhere, I think it was in the greater Detroit area, where there was it was a ride-along, but the population that had changed from, I think they were from like Eastern Europe, and they, some legal, some not, and the language was like Croatian or something, or Estonian or something, so that worked pretty well. But, yeah, in fact, I was going to ask some of our Somali members if someone would volunteer to come to Woodlands to talk about mental health and come to the provider meeting that we have once a week, just to say, you know, sometimes, you know, we want to know what's right and what to do, what to say. And one of the providers says she doesn't, if she knows she has a Somali client, she won't wear pants to work that day. I would be in very bad shape. I could not do that. But just in those kinds of things. Improving cultural awareness.
Cultural sensitivity.
I think that's a good thought. We are a very diverse community.
When you talk of right or around, that's just an opportunity to experience what happens in the community.
Yeah. Right,
I assume more at night?
Well, I think it would be up to what the mental health staff thought would be the best time, as well as the officer that would be the driver. You know, it depends, just to see what their day is like. You know, no wonder they can't, you know, babysit someone who's in need of mental health care. I think that increases sensitivity, because, you know, I know we go through a lot of very interesting people. I was on call last week, it was a full moon, it was quite interesting. But challenging too, because police get involved and EMTs, and so.
I think that was very, very good, very helpful. Thank you for lining that up. Let's see, next on our agenda is to discuss educational ideas. So we kind of just did that. So if I may, I'd like to just discuss this letter we got back from the city, or from the county. Yes, regarding interpreting at the county. My impression from this letter was that there's different viewpoints on the services provided. Seems like the county doesn't think there is an issue at all, and that they have different methods. You know, they have a telephonic interpreting service. If
I think the letter was sort of saying that services are available basically all day.
Right.
And the other message was slightly different than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, right.
Yeah. And I think they both could be right. Perhaps the message is no one knows, perhaps, in a certain area that hasn't been communicated how to navigate that system.
Mm-hmm.
They had an answer that was clearly delineated. We have X, Y, and Z, but obviously the clientele that's using it don't know how to navigate X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And so there's a communication breakdown. I'm not gonna call one group a liar or not, but obviously, that's not being communicated.
Right.
Larry Kleindl did talk to me at a chamber connection, I think I told you that, you know, after they received the letter, and I did invite him to get a hold of you, to come to the meeting and talk about it. One of the things that I know with the language line, it is hard to navigate the language line at times, and I think one of the points from what I heard from our committee members is just some of these appointments, people are waiting so long that then the opportunity of the time that the actual interpreters are there passes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by the time their appointment goes, because that's how that waiting room is every day. There's just tons of people sitting in there waiting and waiting and waiting, and when you have a, you know, a 20-minute appointment, especially like with a financial worker, and you're trying to have an interpreter, it turns then into a 40-minute appointment, and you're not understanding back and forth, and there's even miscommunication, or you don't have the right paperwork with you, and it gets drawn out, and then the next person's appointment gets pushed back, and then the next person, I mean, it's very complicated on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I don't know what the answer is, but the language line is very expensive, and it's difficult too, because they aren't right there seeing, you know, like I said, especially with the financial stuff, which a lot of them are there for, if they're missing pieces of their documentation or paperwork, the language line person can't see what they have in their hands. So they're not knowing always what they're talking about. And they're trying to ask the person, do you have this? And the client may or may not know what they're talking about, and the interpreter on the phone can't see, and it gets even more drawn out.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a very complicated issue.
With the interpreter to do a psych eval. It takes usually an hour, and then that's about sometimes two.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the same issue.
Yes.
And usually, but we don't use the telephone interpreter. We have an interpreter there.
Okay, I was very impressed with the county's program and their policy. I mean, it's extensive. So I think probably Sean has a point. It's
yes.
How do we get everybody to understand and use it? And it's not going to be an easy fix.
Right. No, because they have done, they have improved leaps and bounds of what they have. Because, I mean, this, you know, it was just an issue that just popped up, and they have done well to do the best they can on their end. But it's very complicated on both sides, you know, financially and, you know, like, we both said a 20-minute appointment doubles with an interpreter there because everything is said and interpreted.
Three times.
And then trying to explain sometimes because they don't know what that word means, and it's very difficult.
Are there directions of how to navigate all of those elements available in these languages?
But here's the problem. Most of the people who are coming there have not been educated, so they can't read or write their language. So, like for us too, our headquarters are saying, sure, we'll have the handbook in Somali. It's like, well, no, the people we're working with, unless they've been here for a while now in the school system, they can't read or write their own language. So even to have written instructions in their language doesn't help them. Because there was no education system.
So we do do have that.
Yes.
It just isn't going to help every case.
It isn't going to help because they can't read it.
Right.
You know.
So
I know in the safety industry, I have a friend who works for hand in hand with our turkey industry, and they've worked on safety training without words, to try to have this sort of cutting edge. And it's being done on a national level because this issue is so difficult, right? How do you train people who aren't literate?
We do a lot of pictures. I mean, when we have done, you know, job training, it's take a picture, you know, and your checklist is a picture checklist.
Right.
You know, for cleaning in the hotels or whatever. It's a picture checklist because that's where we're at until they learn the, you know, the repetitive job.
Maybe since this is such a as big of a deal as it is, the interpreting issue, maybe it's something we hold a program for the Somali community, have an interpreter there, and so the county can explain what the process is.
I
mean, it's a big enough problem, a big enough community of Somalis that it wouldn't be in vain, I don't think.
I can see, like, with the Karen population, they're relatively new here. They're a small, isolated group out of a remote country in a remote part of the country. And I think that's a very, they're really a very primitive, unsophisticated group of people.
Right. And, but many of them, though, are more educated.
Pardon?
Many of them that have come, because we worked with them when they were coming from Minneapolis, too, and working at Genio, have more education than many of the people coming from East Africa.
Oh, really?
So if they had translated brochures, they could read their language.
They had from what I heard, because we had a family come through our church, and they had a lot of missionaries. They went to missionary schools. They have, you know, a lot of people who have come here are Christian. So they're used
some are Buddhist, but most of the ones here are
Baptist.
Pretty evangelical.
Because of the mission.
So they may have starved, but they've got a lot of religious education.
What I like to propose, and since it seems like the main issue we're dealing with right now is the Somali interpreter issue, I'd like to respond to this letter saying, we understand you have a system in process. We think that the issue is the communicating it to the Somali community, and we'd like to facilitate a program where the county can come and explain this to the Somali community. There'd be a interpreter there, and they can explain the process. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I'm wondering if we should invite Larry and Anne to come first
to hear
and see what, you know, how they have tried to communicate that out.
Sure.
And I feel like our East African brothers here should be.
Yeah.
They should be there too.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So no response to this, but invite Larry and
I mean, or the response could be to have them come and, I mean, I guess that's what I would propose, to see, you know, what their thoughts on that are.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
Because that would be a stopgap thing anyway, right until the
shoot. I agree. I think that would be the fair thing to do, to let them kind of explain their side of it, but it is an issue. We need it, and it's something maybe we can get our arms around and work on.
And again, maybe what they have here is more than adequate.
Maybe.
We don't know, right?
Right. All right. So my response will be to ask them to come to our next meeting on the 18th then.
And make sure that, you know, I didn't want to read between the lines, but I mean, it was sort of, it didn't feel completely defensive, but I mean, they're trying to defend their position. Mm-hmm. Asking them to come, make sure that, you know, that's not another, we didn't find your answer adequate.
Right.
We totally get the response, but we're looking for some next steps then into how we can bridge the gap of communication.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What their feelings are, how we can help bridge this gap.
Yep.
And I did try to convey that to Larry when he talked to me that morning, but that you know, we want to have a conversation about what they're doing, so things we can do to help support what they're doing, or, you know, find out more information about it.
I'm thinking this might be an issue for a face-to-face and not a letter, so because letters can cause, misunderstanding. So I'm wondering, Shelley, if you'd be willing to talk to Larry, since you've had some communication with him, and invite him personally to the next meeting.
I can do that.
And,
you know, just I'm thinking that, you know, when someone is approached by a city you know, commission that's affiliated with the city government, you know, it's kind of like, oh, I don't want to get involved, you know, I'm not, you know, they do get defensive.
Right.
So I think this is a great opportunity for the community or that part of the community, human resources, I guess, or human the development, HR, whatever.
Human rights.
Do we need a motion?
No, not them, but I mean the human services people need to know that we're here to help.
Okay.
You know, we're here to help their cause, not, we're not out to go in somebody's face.
These are the Nuremberg trials.
What's that?
These are the Nuremberg trials.
Well, very good. I think we're, you know, making progress here and trying to figure out what our commission is going to do. So thank you, everybody. Our next meeting will be October 18th. And we'll hopefully have Larry and Ann here.
Okay, so October 18th?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's the third Tuesday of the month.
Mm-hmm. And it's on the agenda here, too. So
yeah, the other letter?
We haven't heard anything back on that. So,
what
I don't
know. The other letter?
The that was for the swimming.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Maybe we should see if we can.
Providing, you know, I'm just thinking what Barbara just said. And, you know, the city comes in there. This is the city. And that is one of the people. And I don't want to go after that person directly either, but.
I saw him coming all the way across the room. We were at the municipal utilities, and all of a sudden he's like, "Shelly," and I'm like, "Oh God, what did you do now?" And then I was like, "Oh, it's not even about work. Okay, what?" Yeah. And so, and he said, "I got this letter," you know, and I just said, "Just settle down. You know, this is what the discussion was." And he had gone back and looked at the minutes. So realized it, but he said that he was going to be sending a letter back, or that Anne was. So
good, very good.
Okay.
All right. Can we have a motion to adjourn?
I make a motion to adjourn.
Second.
All right. Motion carried. Thanks, everyone.
Maybe just a reminder that. Did you receive that, Steve? Maybe you might want to think about a response sometime.
Yeah.
It's only like.
Yeah.
I don't need to.
Exactly.
But
we only want it addressed before the spring summer venture comes out.
Before people are swimming again.
Right.
Yeah.
Can I share this with everybody? I didn't really want it part of the meeting, but this is.